They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. On the Commons with me today, I have the distinct pleasure of talking to Neil Brooks. I'm going to let Neil tell you his story because I don't think I would do it a whole lot of justice. Neil, thank you so much for taking time out of your life to tell us what's been going on with you, and it's not a happy story.
Hi, Shu. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back. It's been probably just about 3 years. No, the story is straining the ability of my friends and family to stay connected because, you know, we always want things to get better. And definitely in my case, things have gotten worse. I was declared disabled and taken out of work in 2004 because my eyes were chemically burned. So I have chronic pain in my eyes. And that pain was managed with pain medicines and with these ridiculously expensive plastic salad bowl contact lenses that I had to fill with fluid and literally use plungers to put into my eyes. And with those lenses, I could be fairly functional. And like a lot of people in the country, I didn't look disabled if you think of what most people think of when you think of a disabled person.
Right.
I looked fairly normal. In 2008, my wife and I moved from the West Coast to Colorado, and we had found a neighborhood that looked wonderful and welcoming and friendly, and we bought a house where the lot was still dirt, so there were no foundation walls, there were no walls, there was just dirt, and we had a chance to work on customizing some of the interior. We couldn't change anything structural that had already been through the city. And once the walls started coming up under construction, we realized that the house was not only about 5 or 6 feet from the neighbors, but the back of our house went all the way back to our lot line. And the next door neighbor's house, the front of their house lined up with ours, but the back of their house stopped in about the middle of our house, which meant that their backyard was parallel with our master bedroom. And my wife said, "This is awfully close," and it turned out it was awfully close. And the neighbors had a couple of young dogs, and the dogs barked a lot, and the dogs barked incessantly, and they barked all the time when they were left alone, and they were left alone a lot. And the barking was so loud that even in a well-insulated Colorado house, there was no escape from the barking, no matter what I did. Windows closed, fans on, TVs on, try to sleep in the basement, doors closed. It was just so loud that it would wake you up. And it did wake me up. It would wake me up over and over and over. And my health began to fall apart. And I, of course, went back to doctors, and I started on antibiotics. And about 2 months after moving in, I had waited. I didn't want to reach out to neighbors being so new. And I thought maybe they needed a little time to adjust to new neighbors and get their dogs under control. When things didn't get better, I wrote them a nice note and said, "Hey, this is a real problem for me. I'm disabled, and I need my sleep, and this is starting to take a toll on me." And at first, the neighbors were nice, but the problem didn't stop, and that forced me to keep reaching out to them in civil and decent ways and asking for help. And soon they got tired of me asking for help, and they decided, "Hey, dogs bark, and that's just the nature, and you're going to have to live with it and leave us alone."
Why were the dogs barking, Neil? Was there a problem?
The problem apparently was that some breeds are really prone to separation anxiety. And when they're left alone, they panic. And as the dog psychologists eventually told me, barking helps to soothe them. So they bark. And they barked, literally, if they were left alone for 8 hours, they would bark nonstop for 8 hours.
Wow.
And, of course, you know, when you close the refrigerator door, you don't know whether the light goes on or off. Well, when my neighbors were away, they didn't know the dogs were barking. And when they got home, the dogs weren't barking. So as far as my neighbors were concerned, I was making it up. So once the neighbors said, not only are we not going to help you, but you're starting to bother us, and if you don't stop bothering us, we're going to sue you. Once they had said no more communication with you, I had to go to animal control. I had to go to the police. I had to go to the property manager of the HOA. And then I had to go to the HOA itself and plead my case. I'm disabled. This is costing me sleep. My health is falling apart. I've tried everything I could with the neighbors, but I've reached a dead end. Can you please help me? And the answer was always, no, we're just not going to help you. Now, by this time,
you think they'd love an opportunity to start finding people, huh?
Yes.
they dropped the ball on that one, Neil, somewhere along the line.
Well, you know, the thing I learned was it's really a rotten position to be the last one into an established community where everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
Because you're automatically asking people to take sides. And this was a tight-knit bunch, and nobody even had a chance to meet me. And they told me, we're not going to do anything to harm our neighbors and our friends, and you're the problem. And I ran out I would like to say very quickly, but it wasn't very quickly. I moved slowly and methodically and begged the appropriate people for help, and I just kept getting told no help. And eventually my health got so bad that I kept having to drive an hour and a half down to Denver to see specialists and get IVs, and I was on antibiotics, antivirals, antifungals, and steroids, and they couldn't get my health stabilized, and I wound up getting a lawyer. And I said, I don't want to sue anybody. I just need you to write, you know, a nasty note saying my client can't sleep in his own house and you have to stop. And that turned the rest of the neighborhood on me. I hear all these stories from other people, and if you complain, everybody turns against you. Well, that's exactly what happened. And they don't become interested in the story, and they don't become interested in the truth. They just single you out. And people were singling my wife and me out. We'd get yelled at, and obscenities would be screamed at us, and people tried to run us off the road. And, you know, I would just be driving back and forth to doctors, and these people with big trucks would try to run me off. It was terrible. And they were all my neighbors. I filed police reports, but nothing got better. And when it came to court, the judge invoked the business judgment rule that basically says we don't interfere in the decisions made by homeowners associations. And the judge threw out my case before I got my day in court. And when he threw out my case, he awarded the HOA lawyers their fees. So by this time, it had taken all of my life savings and it had taken my health. The long story short was this made the neighborhood, who had turned against me, really proud of themselves, and it made them very sure that they were on the side of the angels and that nobody was going to interfere with them no matter what they did to me. And they really started ratcheting up the retaliation. They would rev their engines on their motorcycles and their bicycles. They would plow in my driveway with all the snow from the neighborhood. I mean, they were doing everything they could to get at me and to get me out of there. And that would have been fine if I physically could have moved. I would have, but I was trying to manage my health. So I became a prisoner in my own house, and I know you've heard plenty of those stories.
Oh, yeah.
And spring came. I spent most of the winter hiding out and going to doctors. And spring came, and I got a nasty note from the HOA saying, your landscaping doesn't look good. And I called maybe a dozen landscapers, but they were all booked up. So I started having to go out into my front yard to work on the grass. But I had been harassed by the neighbors so much and denied help by the police that I chose to buy and start carrying, openly carrying a gun on my property. And this was the last straw for the neighbors, and they began calling the police every time they saw me with a gun. And one day the police decided to send the SWAT team to arrest me. I got arrested.
Wow.
I went to jail, and I was a restraining order was put against me that didn't allow me back in my house, so I was forced to sell my house. And that was the last time in June of 2012 that I was ever in that neighborhood. Meantime, my health continued to fall apart. So I moved into a long-term hotel near some family, and I tried to make a plan to go to the tropics because my chemically burned eyes do much better in high humidity. And I literally went to Central America for about 4 months, but it turned out that everywhere you went, they had ceiling fans blowing. And all that moving air eventually tore my eyes up, and I had to leave Central America.
Wow.
I came back to the States. I stayed with family, and I kept getting sicker. I just couldn't fight off the infections. I was concerned about all the meds they were putting into my body, so I basically stayed with family and tried to rest up for a while. And then I realized that the most important thing to regaining my health was to try to get those custom contact lenses back. I couldn't wear them because I kept falling asleep in my lenses, which was a definite no-no. I kept falling asleep because I was sleep-deprived because of the barking dogs. So I had to try to get back to the clinic in Boston. And that fitting process is a 6-week process, and it's very painful. So I went to pain doctors and said, how can we get my pain under control? And the pain doctors said, we should give you this anticonvulsant. And they gave me an anticonvulsant medication, and I had a near-fatal reaction to that medication. My liver was failing. They thought it was about a 20% chance I was going to die, and I was bedridden for about 3 months. When I got well enough after that, I flew to the Mayo Clinic to try to figure out what was wrong. And the Mayo Clinic literally said to me, you're just not lucky. But if I were you, I would never take another drug unless it was absolutely necessary to save my life. From the Mayo Clinic, I flew back to Colorado to stay with my wife in her new house. And my plan was to try to get my health back and then try to see other parts of the country to see if I could find a place where the climate was more suitable to my particular medical issues. But within a couple of months of being back at my wife's house, I started having heart trouble. And the trouble manifested itself as dizzy spells and fainting and shortness of breath and palpitations. And over the course of a couple of years, I kept seeing different heart doctors, and they kept saying, well, it's just an arrhythmia. It's no big deal. But everything in my gut said, no, I think it's a little more serious than that. And each doctor would do more tests, and there would be abnormal test results. But they said, no, I'm not worried about those abnormal results. It's really just an arrhythmia. But I kept at it. I kept going to different doctors, and I kept seeing abnormal test results. And I did as much of my own research as I could. And I started to believe that I was in heart failure and that the data supported that conclusion. And I would present my case to each of the heart doctors, and I would say, you know, if this is unclear, I think we need to do a right heart catheterization. We need to snake a tube in my neck and go into my heart and solve the puzzle. But they all said, no, you know, we're sure it's not heart failure. There's no indications for putting a tube in your neck. So, you know, just don't worry about it. And when you're ready, we can do surgery on your heart. But I never thought their answer was right, and the more I looked at it, the more I thought their answer was wrong. So I just referred myself last month to a specialty clinic in Boston that did do the invasive testing. And the results of the invasive test were clear. I'm in an untreatable form of heart failure that they call heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And I also have pulmonary hypertension. So basically what they diagnosed me with were two fatal diseases, one of which is a little bit treatable and the other of which is not. And they said, it looks like I've probably had both of these conditions for all of 3 years, and that's bumping me right up against the usual life expectancy for this kind of heart failure.
Wow. So there's nothing they can do to help you?
I'm now in contact with the nation's leading experts in this kind of heart failure. There's one or two at Johns Hopkins. There are two at Mayo. There are a couple of Vanderbilt people. And I'm talking to all of them, and they all have my records. And they've all said, let me figure out if I can offer you anything. But generally what they said was the things we can test for and the things we can find really only make it worse. You know, there are a couple of cancers, there are a couple of systemic illnesses that can cause this, but they don't make the prognosis better. They tend to make it worse. But at this point, I really want to know. The news might not be good, but I really want to know. So I'm still waiting to see who's willing to see me first.
So I'm really very sorry to hear about all of this, Neil. And I think this sort of goes to what Gary Solomon has been saying all along, that HOAs really do make you sick.
And it's hard to explain to anybody, because the first thing you always hear is, why don't you just move? But anybody that knows a handful of people knows that there are a ton of reasons why people can't move. You know, we bought our house in 2008, which was the middle of the financial crisis. It would have cost us over $100,000 to sell if we could have sold our house. And that's even before my health fell apart. So when people say, why don't you move? For some people, that's the right answer. But for other people, it's not even a possibility.
Yeah.
But when you're in a situation from which there is no escape, just the situation itself, no matter what's going on around you, feeling trapped in the midst of a really hostile situation, takes a horrible toll on your health.
I've heard from people, I've heard from so many people where the neighbors have gone after them, where they've tried to run them over, where they've gone in and destroyed their property. Where they've, there was a president in one HOA, and I think it was in Texas someplace, who was fining homeowners because they had dog poop in the yard, because they were, you know, whatever it was. So they got cameras. And unbeknownst to the president, who went by and brought his dog over to their front yard to do his business, left it there, came by with a beer and can of beer, open can of beer. Their truck was parked on the street in front of their house, threw the contents of the beer into their truck and threw the can in there. And all of this was caught on film. And one of the local TV stations or newsletters, newspapers or whatever, actually posted that, and they broadcast the tape, the video, and the president had to sell and move. But that sort of thing happens all the time. It is really terrifying. I have a lady who used to call me all the time, and she was afraid of answering the door, answering the phone, checking her mail. She was just absolutely terrified. I had another lady who, I mean, her story was horrible. I don't know what happened to her. But she said that every time she went anywhere, they would try to run her down. I've had so many people tell me that they tried to, that the association, the neighbors tried to run them down. It happens once, you think it's an isolated incident, right, CAI? It doesn't happen once. It happens all the time. And here you are, you're telling me the same story.
I think, and I know I've heard you talk about this, and I don't think you're going to argue with me, it's a structural problem, because you start with the assumption that the power that you're handing to people in these neighborhoods, they are mature enough, experienced enough, rational enough, objective enough, and professional enough to wield that power in a reasonable and appropriate way. And even the nature of the rule in court that says we're going to give the benefit of the doubt to HOAs assumes that HOAs are universally populated and directed by rational actors. But I think if you've been out in this country and in this world enough, you know that, unfortunately, the vast majority of people don't merit that kind of power. They're unqualified. You know, they may be elected, but especially in smaller communities. And ours had only about 44 homes, only a percentage of which were occupied by people who were interested in governing at all. And, you know, we don't tend to get the best as leaders. Yeah. We tend to get the most willing or those with questionable motives. And the people who chose to lead in the community I lived in were the quote-unquote popular clique. And they were looking to protect the interests of them and their friends without regard to the actual best interests of the community. And what we see time and time again in so many of these neighborhoods, I always say it devolves just the way the story of Lord of the Flies devolved. You know, it was a dozen school-age kids on an island who had to self-govern. And we want to think that if you're 25 or 30 and you went to college, that that'll never happen to you. But I think it happens by default, unless you get a really exceptional set of people or an exceptional set of circumstances, because this is a layer of government in my life and yours that has absolutely no oversight.
It's, yeah, you're absolutely right. There is no oversight. There's no transparency. There's no sunshine. Anybody who tries to provide it, any homeowner who asks for questions is sort of dubbed a troublemaker, and of course they're just abused and harassed, kind of the way you were. And that's the wrong way to do that. Oh, well, you must have done something wrong. Oh, well, that you're just a troublemaker. But it's interesting that I had someone from CAI yell at me because I was pointing out all of the embezzlement stories. I mean, the millions and millions and millions of dollars that have been embezzled from HOAs. And I was yelled at because it was our fault for not providing the oversight. What's wrong with you homeowners? You get in there and you think you're just going to sit there and not do anything, and then you're going to whine and complain because your money's gone. Really? So what happens to people who ask for the information? They don't get it. They're dubbed troublemakers. Why do you want it? You don't need it. You can't have it.
Well, and as you described in this Texas situation where they used video cameras, it's worse than being dubbed a troublemaker. You are next. You are the next target.
Yes.
And as you know, they can contrive no end of ways to put you in violation.
Yes.
While you're trying to defend yourself, you're accruing additional violations, which are all being handled by the lawyers. The penalties are now 10 times, or the fees are now 10 times the penalties. And the next thing you know, while you're still trying to prove you did mow your grass, they have a lien on your house. So there are ways to get you out. And, you know, I think it's only the IRS and HOAs where you're guilty until proven innocent. I can't think of another institution that sort of formally doesn't put the burden of proof on the HOA. That business judgment rule is a presumption of guilt on the part of the justice system that if an HOA made a decision that it was a reasonable decision and they were in the right. How do you give, you know, an elected but unqualified group of people the legal benefit of the doubt without putting the onus on them to prove that everything they did was justified?
You know,
I don't understand that.
I don't know either, but for years I've been saying that this is a dysfunctional system. It will not work. I don't care how often you massage it, tweak it, caress it, speak nicely to it, beg and say pretty please. It's not going to work. It is a screwed up system. It's totally dysfunctional. It's flawed.
Well, and one of your guests, Nyla Ridings, you know, we all know her quite well, and Nyla was the first person to say to me when I explained to Nyla that my mother lives in a covenant-controlled community with a fairly reasonable board. And Nyla's words haunted me. She said they're only one vote away.
Yeah.
And I realized she's exactly right.
We've been saying that on this show since day one. You're one election away. Because people will come to me and say, oh, sure, you mean, you don't mean all HOAs. You mean some HOAs. I go, no. I mean, all HOAs. Oh, well, we don't have that problem. Really, where do you live? And they tell me, and I go, but I just heard from people. You were in the papers the other day. What do you mean we don't have that problem? Yes, Sue, but you don't understand. My neighbors had problems, but we don't have problems.
Yeah. And you know what, Sue? I haven't been held up at gunpoint in this town, but it doesn't mean there's no crime. You know, when people say my grandmother smoked and she lived to be 95, I don't think that means smoking is good for you. And when somebody tells me I love my HOA, I'm happy for them. But that doesn't mean you don't have a sizable percentage of neighbors who are suffering through no fault of their own, because it tends to become a popularity contest, and there's no rhyme or reason to who's popular. And if you're unpopular, there are insidious ways that they can deal with you. And as you said, they can have their own dogs go to the bathroom on your lawn, or they can plant beer cans in your trucks. And it doesn't have to be that overt. You can just become a pariah where you don't feel comfortable in the house you've put all your hard-earned money into. And I don't think, from my life's experience, it's never happened to me, you know, neighbor turning on neighbor in a non-HOA community. And I think the percentage of times that neighbors call code compliance officers for property violations in non-HOA neighborhoods are dramatically low. You know, I was asking you once before, and I've asked other people, as I drive around the city I live in, the most desirable old neighborhoods don't have HOAs, and they are the most desirable neighborhoods.
Yeah.
How did we function in communities before there were HOAs? And the answer is, I don't know, but we did.
We were communities then, because if you look at the description of a community, it's a group of people who have something in common. And you'd think that location would give you something in common. You'd think that, you know, if it's a neighborhood with a lot of children, then you're a young family, you have something in common. You have to pull it together. But the minute you have someone, one of your neighbors has more power over you and over everybody else, then you've got this imbalance, and it's no longer a community. It's no longer where everybody's on an equal footing.
Well, I think it then becomes the Stanford-Milgram experiment, where they divided themselves up into the guards and the inmates, and suddenly the guards had power, and they started abusing the inmates.
Exactly. And that's exactly what's happening.
I think you're exactly right about power, but I also think that you used to buy a house, and your goal was to stay in your house and stay in your job for a lot of years, and when you retired, you either sold your house and moved south, or you left it and all its equity to your kids. But we treat our houses now as though they're stocks to be day traded.
Yeah.
So you have one faction in control who is concerned with power, and you have the other faction who says, our houses must all look alike, or we will not be able to profit as handsomely as otherwise. And that tells one neighbor that the other neighbor is costing them money. And it pits neighbor against neighbor, and of course the people who profit the most from that contention are the lawyers.
You know, there's this backlash against these cookie-cutter homes, and that's exactly what this cookie-cutter monstrosity really is. People look at it and they go, I don't want a cookie-cutter home. But yet they think that if you've got something that's different, if your house numbers are different, if your house numbers are fancier, or they're gold, or they're a little bit bigger, or they're a little bit smaller, then you're devaluing property.
That's exactly right.
If you've got three rose bushes instead of two rose bushes, then you're devaluing property because it's cluttered. I mean, the insanity, the sheer and utter insanity of the way people look at these HOAs is just mind-boggling. It makes no sense. If people would just stop and think.
That's the problem. We view it passively. We accept what we're being told. But still, I think it's important enough for me to repeat, the most desirable neighborhoods in my town are older, established, non-conforming, have no HOAs. The houses don't line up either. One is set a little farther back on its property. One's a little farther forward. They were built by individual homeowners using individual builders. And if somebody has two rose bushes instead of three, the only thing you notice is that it's a beautiful house. if somebody actually had the audacity to put a basketball backboard on top of their garage, you don't notice it because there's so much heterogeneity in the architecture and in the setbacks and in the style that all you see are beautiful houses. But when you build, you know, when my wife bought her house, she laughed. She said, they're not cookie cutter. There's four different floor plans. And I thought, you know, in the old neighborhoods, there are 100 houses with 100
different floor plans. The thing, Neil, is that the older ones are better built because as HOAs are mandated and as local municipalities are washing their hands of the entire neighborhood, except when it comes to collecting taxes, there are no inspections. There are no standards. There's nothing. The developer is allowed to cut corners. Sometimes the developer will just pick up a day laborer and say, you're the inspector. You go ahead and inspect the property. Yeah, it works. Okay, fine. There we go. Off we go. But there, you know, in the old days, you actually had standards. You actually had building codes. You actually had to use proper construction material to build something that's going to last. I look at the million-dollar boxes of garbage that go up that are made of cardboard and scotch tape around here, and there's $1 million, and everybody goes, ooh, ah, ooh, isn't that pretty? They're right on top of each other. There's no backyard. You can reach out, lean out your window, and kiss your neighbor good night behind you. I mean, they're making it easy. You don't need to exercise to go over and say, hello, Neil. You just reach over the balcony, and there you go. But it's a tragedy. It's a travesty. It's an absolute travesty.
I think, you know, my story is a perfect example of exactly what you're saying. I understand there are some really good reasons in the long run for increased density. There are some. But when you stack people on top of people, you have to expect problems. And the way that the municipalities have structured deals with the builders is exactly what you're saying. They wash their hands of the responsibility that they basically took a huge part in creating by increasing density. Mm-hmm. And in my case, you know, it wasn't even subtle when I called the county, which was animal control, and called the city, which was the police, and told both of them, the laws are being violated, your laws. They said, well, that's a neighbor problem, and you live in a homeowners association.
Because they're distancing themselves from it. You know, why pay the police and animal control to come and take care of it if they can just say, hey, that's a civic problem. You just go to court.
You're exactly right. Yeah, and we all understand that when it comes to your streetlights or your snow removal or your infrastructure, that's a real problem. But you would think when there are literally crimes being committed or civil infractions being committed, that if they were in a different neighborhood, would get police response. You would think that for life safety or health or welfare, you know, infrastructure is one thing, and it's hugely serious. It's going to bankrupt a lot of these HOAs. But if I called and said my neighbor's running a meth lab, I don't think they'd tell me to call the HOA. But
you
they're starting
know.
To figure out which laws they want to enforce on private property and which laws they don't. And that's a scary, slippery slope.
Here's where the problem is. We have been lied to. We are not able to sift through all the nonsense that we've been fed. We just accept everything that we're told. And so that sort of stays uppermost on our minds. The fact is, we're being used, we're being abused, we're being lied to, and we're being all of this is by the local municipality. The fact is, they work for us. They're supposed to work for us.
I was going to say.
They're supposed to work for us. We're working for them. And as long as taxpayers and constituents refuse to open their eyes and refuse to understand what they've got and what's going on, it's going to continue. I think that if we band it together, we have the power. We have the numbers on our side. You have to understand and realize that you're being lied to.
I think, again, I think you're exactly right. And one of the biggest examples of that, I think, is that I've been made aware over the years of numerous industry-generated surveys that show that the features that define these HOA communities are not the features that home buyers want. So when you talk about the economics of municipalities dealing with HOAs, the builder wins, the municipality wins, the homeowner loses. But it turns out that's not the only front on which the homeowner loses. The homeowners don't have choices. And as we all know, that in many parts of the country, those choices are becoming more and more scarce. They aren't choosing to buy in HOA communities. They don't have choices. The old neighborhoods that don't have HOAs and that are desirable for other reasons have no turnover because people love living in there. And they don't view it as a stock to be day traded. They want to raise their kids and have their families and pass the house on to their kids. But the new neighborhoods tend to be occupied by a lot of people with kind of flipper mentalities. And the flippers wind up having to sell their buyers with the same line of nonsense that sold them in the first place. You know, people don't want the pools and the tennis courts and the golf courses and the gyms and the community centers. But that's what we keep getting. And I think in large part we keep getting it because every month when you write a homeowners association dues check, that goes to people. And that goes to people who don't want to give it up.
Wayne Hyatt, who's the former CAI president, lives in Georgia, I think. He was on a show I had before on the Commons. And he wrote a law review article, and he came on and he said that Nobody wants the swimming pools, the tennis courts, the trails, all of the amenities. So, Wayne, why are we building them? Because the developer thinks that it's an amenity that's going to help him sell the house. So we've known, and now this show's in its 18th year, so we've known for over 20 years that people don't want these amenities, that the uses were down. That was one of the selling points. You buy into an HOA, you'll, for just pennies a month, you will have lived the life of the rich and the famous. You'll have a pool, and you'll have this, and you'll have that. Well, people don't want this and that and the other, and we know that, but we still build them.
I suspect that it's because, you know, the builders, I love to say it, it's dramatic for effect. They're evil, but they're not stupid. So everybody that's been in marketing knows there's a huge disconnect between what people say and what they do. And at least on the front end, a lot of this glitzy stuff and the trails and the golf courses and the pools and the equestrian centers, they make for really good copy. And I do think they create buying decisions in the minds of people, even if those people never, ever use them. So the builders, they're not stupid. If, you know, they wouldn't spend the money to put these things into their neighborhood if they didn't help with sales. But I think what you're finding is that sometimes when they're surveyed, the people who are surveyed realize it's like that waffle iron. I've never used it.
Yeah.
And yet every month I write a big check, you know, so that the lawn can stay green throughout a drought and so that my neighbors can fight with each other over drainage and sewage and retention ponds. And I think the other economic piece that we've always talked about is that I don't remember in non-covenant-controlled neighborhoods lawyers being a part of your everyday life.
They're not.
I've always said that the lawyers' interests are so different from yours and mine. And they aren't interested in, hey, you two kids, go talk it out in your bedroom until you work it out. They like to throw gasoline on fires because they make a lot of money off of gasoline and fire.
There was a couple of points I want to make. I remember about 20 years ago there was an article from California where a developer built a development and he put in a covenant that said no lawyers allowed. So lawyers were not allowed to buy in this development. One of them, a lawyer came in and tried to buy in there and was told, no, you're a lawyer, you're not allowed to. There's a covenant here. So he sued. He sued the developer and said it was discrimination. The judge said lawyers are not a protected class, so there's no discrimination there. But even the developer didn't want to have lawyers in the association.
Wow.
I mean, I wish more of them would do that. The other thing here, you keep talking about older developments, older neighborhoods. The houses are better, they're better built, they're nicer, they're actual communities. People get on well. They also have more room. They're not on top of each other like you were describing your house.
In my story, the importance of the point you raised cannot be overstated. And I had to learn about the math. And it's not worth going into here, but there's an exponential relationship between distance and sound.
Yeah.
So when somebody tells me, well, my house is 25 feet from my neighbor's and yours was 5 feet, how much difference could that make? It's the difference between background noise and a jackhammer.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the space between old houses, and you're exactly right, in this part of Colorado, all the old houses are 25, 35, 40 feet apart, and the difference is huge.
They're unbelievably huge. On quarter acres, they're on a third of an acre, they're on a half acre. But here's what's happening in places like Fairfax County, Virginia. They're saying that's not smart growth.
Right.
So they're going in and they're tearing down these older neighborhoods. And they're replacing them with cardboard boxes held together with scotch tape, piled one on top of the other. And we've got these wonderful new urbanism, walkable, friendly neighborhoods. You can live on top of the shop. And you can do this, and we're going to take care of you from cradle to grave. And so the old places are going. So if you have one, or if you're in a position of getting one, I would suggest that you get one and flat refuse to sell it. Be a holdout.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be a holdout. Record something. I used to tell people, record a covenant on your property. Anybody can record a covenant on their property. It takes whatever it is, $10, $20, $30 to record it in the land records, but say that this property will never be part of a mandatory membership homeowner association.
If you buy one of those, you've just bought a vintage 1950s Corvette, because they won't be making them anymore,
right.
And the rest of them will be gone, and you'll be the last happy person in America. One of the things that most amazes me when we talk about proximity and acreage, that families can be attracted to these HOAs, and yet you and I hear no end of story where the cranky neighbor can't stand the sound of the kids playing in the yard. Well, understandably, though, the kids are 4 feet away. And in the old family-friendly neighborhoods, again, that sound just went off into the troposphere. It never bothered anybody because the walls weren't touching. And I don't know that families ever consider that they've moved into a place where, just like an apartment building, you know, we always think if it's a single family, we'll be able to do what we want. But I don't think people understand the impact of proximity when they think about the kids bouncing a basketball. You know, I don't want to be the cranky old neighbor, and I never was. But at some point, you realize that's a lot closer than it ever was in my entire life. And, you know, when it's 5 a.m. and the kid's playing basketball before school, I can see how somebody might be awakened by it. And again, it's all because of proximity, which is all because of density, which is all because of economics.
There's that, but also there's just plain nastiness.
There is.
One of my friends, the late Pat Wigington, when I first met Pat, she died, unfortunately, a few years ago. But she had a little boy. And they lived in a condominium. And right outside the condominium, it was an older condominium, so they had these buildings. It wasn't a high rise, I don't know, 2 or 3 stories, whatever it was. And there was this huge grassy area that was kind of away from everything and anybody. And so the kids would go down. You're talking about 5, 6, and 7-year-old kids. And they'd go down and they'd run around and they'd kick the ball and They'd have fun. You couldn't hear anything because I sat in her place, and you couldn't hear anything. But you had these little biddies. They were on the board, and they thought they were better than anybody else, and they didn't want kids around. They wanted the kids to go to the school, unsupervised, alone, out of sight, because they just didn't want to have them there. So this created an entire hate situation in the association, in the condominium. And the papers did stories on them and all of that. So they decided to keep the kids out. What they would do is plant all of these trees. They were going to turn this big open field into a forest. I don't know how it happened, but apparently these trees just started dying one after the other after the other. I don't know whether they were planted with hate and toxicity that they didn't want to thrive, but every one of those trees died.
Wow.
I love it when things like that happen. I absolutely love it. But it was just sheer nastiness. I understand what you're saying about proximity. I understand what you're saying about the noise. This did not contribute to the noise. You couldn't hear it. I mean, it was a wide open space. It was an older development, lots and lots of space, huge, huge grassy area. And the kids were healthier outside running around and letting off steam and getting exercise and playing and being with their friends, and their parents could keep an eye on them.
I think when you get a group that are unreasonable, I always want to hope that that's when the larger community gets involved, because I think there's two things we can't do when we get a complaint. We can't assume it's inherently invalid, and we can't assume it's inherently valid. You have to look at everything on its own merits. And, there are no end of stories. What's funny is my story was about an HOA that refused to enforce the rules. That seems to be the exception. It seems to be draconian enforcement of unreasonable rules that makes the papers. And I understand that rules are there for a reason. I understand we all agreed to abide by them. But I think we always have to ask the question, number one, is this person actually breaking a rule? And number two, is this a rule we all believe needs to be maintained? Because there might have been a rule in that condo about excessive noise from kids playing in the field, but maybe the rule would be better, before sun up or after sundown or after 11 p.m. But you get people who, for some reason, giving them that little bit of power renders them unable to think. They literally can't think. So some of these stories that I've heard, people said, hey, we're just enforcing the rules. I get that. But the rule is just inherently nonsense. When somebody says you have three flower pots on your porch and you're only allowed two, you had to count to see there was a problem. You had to enter their property to get close enough to see there was a problem. And there are no end of stories, as you well know, over people's landscaping. And whenever we see the picture of the landscaping, we think,
what's
I'd
wrong
be
with
proud
it?
To have that guy. It's beautiful, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, what's wrong with it?
So, ask yourself those two questions. Is the rule reasonable to begin with? And then secondly, are they actually violating a rule? But thought goes out the window. And as we've discussed, some combination of the love of power or the belief that your economic interests are in jeopardy, and it's usually a false belief. I keep saying that in this city, the non-HOA communities are going up in value at the exact same rate as the HOA communities, because either a town or a part of town is desirable or it's not.
A lot of these stupid rules are made up as a knee-jerk reaction. There's no need for them. There's no rhyme or reason to have the rules. But something happened, and everybody said, oh, we need a rule, we need a law, we need something, we've got to prevent this from happening. So we come up with all these idiotic rules. Rules are made to be broken, folks. Go break the damn things. If they don't make any sense, get rid of them.
There was a book when I was young that was called something like, You Can't Hitch Your Alligator to a Fire Hydrant on Sunday. And it was a rule, and it was maybe in Michigan, and it was literally still on the books, and it came to be exactly how you described, because somebody did it and said, well, it's not illegal, it's not a crime, well, then we need a law. And, you know, I used to tell people when I was in real estate, the contract was originally one page, and then there was a lawsuit, and then it was two pages, et cetera, et cetera.
And then it takes you an hour to get through the garbage.
Oh, you know, I always tell the story. When my wife and I signed on the close of escrow at our old house, they all asked us, did you read everything? And I said, I didn't read anything, because here's the deal. I assume the rules are reasonable, and I will absolutely abide by them, and I will assume that you're going to ask others to abide by them, too. I was naive.
Yeah,
I was naive.
Yeah. But the thing, here's the thing, too. They'll hand you now the declarations about the size of a phone book of a big city, not these flimsy little things, and they'll expect you to read everything. But there's something in there that says that a certain percentage of your neighbors can change the rules. So you say, yes, I agree to abide by all this, but 70%, and now they're lowering it because CAI comes up with all this garbage, and they think, oh, it's too hard to change, to amend the governing documents, so we need to make it easier. So now half of your neighbors can just blindly sign some stupid thing and say, yeah, let's go ahead and change this rule, and you're stuck. That's not what you agreed to. So when CAI says, but you agreed, say, no, I didn't. I never agreed to that. Oh, but
I think you're exactly right. So part of the problem is, you know, there's an onerous burden for trying to read and understand. They're basically written in pencil. But then the third thing I always say, because every time there's an article about an unhappy homeowner, even with a legitimate gripe, in the comments section, there's 700 people saying, you knew the rules and you moved in.
Right.
But the third thing that I think is more important than the first two about, you know, overly burdensome and they're subject to change, the third thing is selective enforcement.
Yeah.
And people don't understand how common selective enforcement is.
No, that's, you see it at the federal level now, too.
Yes.
I mean, it's all over the place. We like you, so we're not going to enforce it. But we don't like you. Hey, we're going to go after you. And we're going to take away your firstborn.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know that people understand. It's very, one of the problems with the HOA model is that the easiest thing in the world to do is to blame the victim. A, you should have moved. B, you never should have bought there. C, you knew what you were getting into. It's a very simple answer, and it provides us a certain amount of comfort that we're right. But when you start looking closer, and you and I both know this, when you start looking closer, you realize that the people who got seriously harmed were reasonable, acted reasonably, went in with their eyes open, and tried to deal in a fair, honest, equitable, civil, and professional way. But that wasn't how they were responded to. So I think if we can get people to stop writing off the ones who've had horrible HOA experiences as, well, they probably earned it, we might be able to change the nature of HOAs a little more quickly.
We've only got about a minute and a half left, Neil, but one thing I want to throw in there is so many of the advocates, homeowner advocates, are pushing for ADR, and that's really bad. That will throw you under the bus because there's absolutely no oversight. You're giving away everything right off the bat.
Yeah, it's the antithesis of sunlight is the best disinfectant. They want you in a closet, they want you quiet, and they want you where they know the odds are in their favor.
And there's this whole cabal because the association, they go, well, we can pick our own, you know, mediator, arbitrator, or whoever. Yes. But you're only going to be there once. The mediator, the arbitrator, is going to go for the person who's going to give them more business. And that's going to be the HOA because that's where their money comes from. So, again, follow the money. There's just too many traps in this thing that you only find out about when you've been around a long time.
Well, I like to believe that in the HOA equation, the only ones who don't profit are the homeowners.
It is. You're right. It's win-win for everybody else except the homeowners. Somebody's got to foot the bill, right?
Yes, exactly.
Somebody's got to foot the bill, and in this case, it's usually the homeowner. Neil, please stay in touch. I wish you all the very best, and thank you so much for joining us and telling us your story.
Thank you again for having me, Shu.
And thanks to everybody else. Please stay tuned. Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.